This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Anybody in the mood for an old-fashioned year-end best-of show? Well, good, because you've just tuned into one. Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll take another listen to some of our most interesting stories of the past year.
Like what they learn in this building, if it can't be generalized outside of this building, it's not going to be functional for them for life.
We'll learn about a school in Brooklyn that uses applied behavioral analysis to teach children with autism. Hear the frustrations of teachers trying to advance their careers in a tough political and economic climate, and find out about a computer that's making the move from game shows to clinical labs. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Teaching children with autism is tough, important, and ultimately rewarding work. That's the word from the Brooklyn Autism Center, a private, not-for-profit school that provides education and other support for children with autism. The school uses a method called applied behavioral analysis, which they say is a key to reaching and teaching children with autism. Here to talk about the school is Jamie Nicholas, the educational director of the school. We spoke this year, and I asked how children get involved with the school.
Typically what we do is we give tours to parents and we'll show them our program and explain exactly what we do, the intensity of the one-to-one structure. We, you know, kind of take them through and let them observe some of the other kids and, you know, just to make sure that it's what that parent is looking for. We will then actually have them fill out an application and send in any recent evaluations, individualized education plans created by the Board of Ed, any information that they have gathering up into that child's current age. They'll send that in. I'll review all that information. Then I'll actually have the parent bring the child in for assessment to make sure that this program is not too restrictive for their child or not restrictive enough.
And you take children as early as age 5?
Correct. Our charter is from 5 to 21, but currently right now we're taking children ranging from 5 to, right now our oldest student is 13. And, you know, our main goal is to be able to bring the kids in, give them intensive treatment, and then be able to mainstream them back into the regular school district and have them be as independent as possible. But if they need to stay here, they can stay here up through the age of 21, and we will teach them job skills and have them have a job and live life as independently as they possibly can, just like everybody else.
You take students all across the spectrum, from mild to very severe.
Yeah, and if a child was mild, if I were to evaluate a child and they applied to the school and I felt that they needed to be in a different environment around typically developing children and this was too restrictive, that I would not accept them to the school.
Tell us about the school's programs and curriculum.
Our curriculum is it's based on a variety of domains. So basically when a child comes in, I'll sit down and do an assessment. I'll take some baseline data to identify what their skill deficits are, and then I'll tailor a program specifically to that child's needs individually. We will teach across any area that needs to be taught. We'll teach self-help skills. We'll teach domestic skills, language skills, expressive and receptive, vocal imitation to get them talking more. We will do some natural environment teaching to get more spontaneous, pragmatic language. We will work on reading and math, really anything that child needs to learn to increase their skill deficits, to be independent and functional in life, and that's what we'll work on.
How important is, I see you take a lot of field trips and get them out of the school every so often. Is that important for students with autism?
Absolutely. Yeah, we do horseback riding. We take the kids to the Guggenheim. We have a relationship with the Guggenheim. They go to the Guggenheim when it's closed, and they work on art projects there. It's important that, you know, like what they learn in this building, if it can't be generalized outside of this building, it's not going to be functional for them for life. And so it's really important. We take the kids out. You know, they ride the subway. We have a couple students that are learning how to purchase their lunch and snacks that they want. So they have a debit card, and they go to the Key Foods down the street, and they pick out what they want. They put it in a shopping cart. Then they have to pay with their debit card. So all these things that are getting them ready for real life.
You utilize applied behavior analysis. Tell us what this is.
Great. ABA is the only empirical proven method to treat children diagnosed with autism. There's tons and tons of research to support this. And what's most important is if parents are seeing the child are not developing as a typically developing child, or they see that their child has speech and then starts to lose it, they're not making appropriate eye contact. A lot of parents describe their children as quiet and good. They kind of just play in the corner. Some of the signs might be rocking or making vocalizations that sound very inappropriate. And it's important that, you know, diagnosis is the key. The earlier, the better. The more likely that the child is to be able to be more independent and in a less restrictive placement. What we basically want to do is provide them with reinforcement for socially appropriate behaviors and implement consequences or redirection for socially inappropriate behaviors so that they can fit into society. How we do that is through our data collection, we can look at a problem behavior. Say, for example, it might be hitting. So we'll take some data and we'll look at what happens immediately before the behavior. We'll look at what the behavior is and we'll look at the consequence that followed the behavior. And through this data, we can assess and identify what the function of the behavior is. And then through that function, we can develop a behavior intervention plan to decrease that behavior. If we know why the behavior is happening, we can get rid of it.
How involved are the parents?
The parents are very involved. We definitely encourage a lot of parent involvement. You know, they have to be. They have to have a strong grasp on their child's program and be able to follow through with behavior intervention plans at home. They come in every other week for what we call a clinic meeting. We sit down and we review all the data, behavior reduction plans, any programs that are put into place. And if the child's not progressing in a certain area, then we need to make a change. Someone once said that if a child's not learning, it's not that the child can't learn, it's that we haven't found the right way for them to learn it. So we need to make that change and find a way to actually have that child learn. So, and I also actually go out to the home and I do some home visits and do some parent training out in the home as well. We have an open door policy so parents can come in whenever they would like. I give parents homework for master skills that are here that they have to work on at home so it transfers.
You take children as young as 5 years old. What is the oldest you would take a child?
Right now, probably 12 or 13.
Oh, 13. All right. And what would you consider a success story?
A success story is that, you know, we can have a child come into this school and work on all their skill deficits and they can recover, quote unquote, recover or be able to be in a less restrictive environment and be able to be successful in that environment. And we have been able to actually do that in this school. We have one student that we were actually able to transition out of here to a less restrictive environment in their home public school.
And school's only been open since 2007, right?
Yeah, correct. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, he was here for 1 year. One of the things that we actually recently did is a little bit of research on a 28-year-old adult woman with autism. She has never had any treatment in her past. She lives in a group home, and we worked with her for a week. On top of having diagnosis of autism, she had a stroke when she was born, and so the right side of her body is paralyzed. She also, from the stroke, half of her brain is gray matter, and she was also diagnosed with mental retardation. We brought her here. We worked with her for 1 week, and we were able to toilet train her. We were able to get her to use a picture communication system so that she could hand us pictures to tell us what she wants, and she was able to do this with about 15 different pictures. And this was within 1 week, a 28-year-old. So I think the key is that it's never too late for treatment. People can always learn. But you want people with autism to be able to have the best quality of life that they possibly can and to be as independent as they possibly can. I think that's what's most important.
Jamie Nicholas is the educational director of the Brooklyn Autism Center in Brooklyn Heights. You can learn more about the school at brooklynautismcenter.org. After hearing from a teacher as passionate about her students as Jamie Nicholas, it's easy to forget that out of the classroom, it's been a tough few years for teachers. Classes are bigger, pay is down, benefits cost more, pensions are under threat. And in the last year, teachers across the Midwest have been at the center of collective bargaining fights in Wisconsin and Ohio. With all that, how are teachers getting by in today's political environment? Dan Bobkoff has a snapshot.
They assembled in Lila Howard's classroom at Saline High School near Ann Arbor. three generations. Howard's about to retire after years teaching AP psychology. Jason Gumenich teaches government and is in the middle of his career. Then there's David Dolson, a college freshman who had both of the others as teachers.
They were probably two of my favorite teachers in high school, but also just two of my mentors here as well.
Now, he wants to become a teacher and looks to Lila Howard and Jason Gumenich for advice. He knows they love what they do, but he hears from Howard what they're going through.
Taking away your bargaining rights, taking away your job security, your tenure, how you'll be evaluated, money, things like that. So all of the changes that are taking place. So how do you feel about that, David? I mean, are those concerns that you're kind of mulling around in your mind?
Definitely. I mean, the only reason that I'm not 100% sure that I would want to be a teacher is essentially because of those issues. Just the pay for teachers even is not very good, obviously,
right.
Compared to other professions. And there's just no real security right now.
Jason Gumenich and Lila Howard have already seen their pay cut and benefit costs rise. Howard thinks she'll need to get another job in retirement. Jason Gumenich, who's 37 and newly married, is not running out the classroom door, but in the back of his mind, he's thinking what he could do if he were to leave teaching.
I think a lot of teachers need to start thinking
about
Plan B, administration, public policy, business, different opportunities that may be out there.
Overall morale has, I think, drastically changed as a result of what's going on in education.
As David Dolson, the college freshman, hears all this, he begins to realize there might not be opportunities for him at home.
I don't think I could get a job in Michigan in teaching, probably, or even in the Midwest, from what it sounds like.
And he's thinking about alternatives.
Yeah, I've started to look at engineering.
But not so fast. There's some good news for prospective teachers like Dolson. Dr. Kathy Rosemary, who chairs the education department at John Carroll University, says we could soon need a lot of them in the classroom.
In the next 10 years, I see a big shortage because I think classrooms, schools in general, are populated by largely women, and they're in their 50s and 60s. And so I think there'll be a time in the next decade when these folks will be retiring.
Not only that, Craig Brown, a lawyer who represents school boards, says the changes in teachers' contracts can benefit those new teachers entering the field. Loosening seniority rules can help the young get ahead.
You know, we've all read and heard about the teacher of the year in Indiana who got laid off after that school year because she was a young, new, exciting teacher, but she didn't have the seniority to retain her job when the district was faced with financial difficulties.
And for all the angst among teachers and prospective teachers, Lila Howard says this is still a calling. She wouldn't trade this job.
The students are the best thing about teaching. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's being with them every day, working with incredibly wonderful young people, the future of our society.
And as Howard works her last few months in Saline before retiring, all the political focus on teachers has her thinking of running for school board. I'm Dan Bobkoff.
Still to come, remember when Watson was all the rage on Jeopardy? Well, now he wants to be Dr. Watson. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1163. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The announcement made more news than it probably should, but what the heck. A computer was going to be a contestant on Jeopardy. The computer's name, of course, was Watson, a question-answering machine of a type that artificial intelligence researchers have struggled with for decades that can understand questions posed in natural language and answer them. Now that technology is being used in settings a bit more significant than a game show. Here to talk about that is Dr. Rami Arnaud, a professor at Harvard Medical School. We spoke this year about this advance in computer technology.
Let me start with a word about Jeopardy. So for those who've never seen the show, it's a game show of the question-answer variety, and it's been on the air forever, and I used to watch it as a kid. And the way it works is the host reads a clue from a category, and the contestants have 5 seconds to buzz in with a correct answer, and it's got to be phrased in the form of a question. That's kind of the show's thing. And the thing about Jeopardy is the clues can be about just about anything, and they're often tongue-in-cheek. So a category might be called royalty, and the clue might be, this monarch was born in Mississippi in 1935, thank you very much. And for that, the answer would be, who is Elvis Presley? Because he is the king of rock and roll. So contestants not only have to know an awful lot of information, they also have to get the questions and be quick on their feet in order to be able to answer correctly to win. So, you know, that's not the kind of behavior you really expect from a computer. I mean, think of the PC on your desk at work. It works nothing like that. So the challenge of figuring out how to get a computer to win on Jeopardy is what IBM was interested in. And after a bunch of years and a bunch of millions of dollars, they managed to do it. And that's what was so exciting about Watson. It was a machine that was able to get those human questions and get them right. So the integration of huge amounts of data on the other end, which, of course, Watson had to do, well, you know, Google does that every time you do a search. So at least personally, that wasn't the very exciting part about Watson's accomplishment. What was exciting was that Watson got the questions and understood, and it returned not just a web page, but an answer phrased properly in the form of a question. And that was what was so exciting.
Why has the IBM team targeted medicine?
Well, I think without putting too fine a point on it, it's because in medicine, the questions and answers are life or death. I mean, winning on Jeopardy was a nice proof of principle. The Watson team showed that a computer could be programmed to understand human language posed in a natural form and scour amounts of data pretty much instantly to find the right answer. But when you consider the big picture, there are an awful lot of situations other than TV game shows where people have to do just that, and medicine is, of course, one of them. So IBM wants to use Watson to answer questions in medicine because they're important. It's life or death.
Well, that sounds very general.
Well, you know it is, and at this point it probably should be for two reasons. First, answering questions is a pretty general feature of medicine. Everything from what's the result of this blood test to what's the best drug combination for my patient with this cancer. And of course, for a lot of questions in medicine, you don't need anything as complicated as Watson. But the second reason why it should sound general is it's not quite clear yet, at least from outside of IBM, where exactly IBM and the Watson team feel like they're going to have the greatest impact within medicine. At least that's the conclusion from their public announcements. Now, over the past several months, IBM or people collaborating with them have said Watson is being trained to answer the same kind of questions being asked of medical residents, suggesting a United States Medical Licensing Exam Board's kind of capability. But they've also talked about putting it to work on cancer care and genome analysis, and their health advisory board is similarly ecumenical. So throw in the kitchen sink and you're done. And in fact, just a few days ago, the business lead on the Watson project announced that they're no longer even looking for new ideas for Dr. Watson. He said their plate is just absolutely full. So for now, you're right. The Watson team is trying out a bunch of specific things, but from the outside, it's too early to make more than general conclusions.
So do you think Watson will really be taking over for what doctors do?
I think taking over is a strong term. I don't think Watson will take over any more than a calculator took over what mathematicians do. What people do is integrate data, and machines can do that more reliably. That frees us as people to do it in different ways and focus on problems and issues that we didn't have the luxury to before. Instead of wondering or having to guess or looking to the grayest beard in the room to ask, well, you know, to tell you, well, what test should I order? You can have Watson say, you know, in situations like this, the following test gave a positive diagnosis this percentage of the time. This other test gave one a different percentage of the time. What we do with that information is up to us. Watson gives us that information, which was always out there. It's always latent in the data that we collect to the tune of 4.6 billion laboratory test results last year in the U.S. alone. But now we have the luxury of being able to look at hard data and help decide ourselves what to do with it. So Watson's a tool. It'll free us up to provide better service. That said, there are obstacles. Watson's results are only going to be as good as the data that goes into it, and that data availability is an issue. It's an issue because most of this country, at least, still does not have its records electronic. Beyond that, even when data is electronic, it's not always made electronic in a form that's conducive for computers, Watson or any other, to really understand. Beyond that, there is an awful lot of data which is of a different kind to what Watson has had to deal with so far on Jeopardy, pretty much anything that's not text, and that includes EKGs, images of various sorts, including anything from radiology, and actually a number of other examples like that. And so putting all of that together and sort of making sure it works will take time and effort. And finally, at the end of the day, how's this actually going to work? Is this going to be something that I speak into my smartphone and Watson will work kind of like Siri? Will it be something that I, as a community doc out in, you know, in the rural part of the state will have access to? Or will it be something that only the biggest insurance companies will pay multi-millions of dollars to IBM for to get at tertiary care centers? All of those things are very practical, real-world obstacles for Watson to realize its immense promise in this area.
Dr. Rami Arnaud is a professor at Harvard Medical School. He wrote about the implications of Watson in laboratory medicine in the April 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Yes, it really does seem like computers are becoming more like people. In fact, in some circles, diamonds are a computer's best friend. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Throughout history, diamonds have been valued because they are both rare and beautiful. But as Daniel Ladar, professor of chemistry and electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, explains, modern technology has found some amazing uses for diamonds that could make them an engineer's best friend.
In quantum computing, we replace traditional ones and zeros with quantum bits or qubits. Taking advantage of the amazing nature of quantum mechanics, qubits can represent a one and a zero at the same time. This property is called superposition. Qubits also rely on entanglement, a property that Einstein referred to as spooky action at a distance. Entanglement allows particles that have been separated by space to still affect one another. Together, superposition and entanglement may someday allow quantum computers to perform certain calculations faster than traditional computers. So, you might be wondering, will I be checking my email on a quantum computer someday? The answer is probably not. At this point, we believe that the real promise of quantum computers lies in their potential to perform certain specialized calculations, such as random list searches, more rapidly than is in principle possible on their classical counterparts. Essentially, superposition allows quantum computers to search through all the possibilities at once, and entanglement creates stronger than classical correlations between potentially correct answers. However, there is a problem. Quantum computers are difficult to build on a large scale since they fall victim to decoherence, which you can think of as the noise that knocks qubits out of superposition. To address this, my colleagues and I worked out and built a design for a prototype quantum computer in a diamond, using subatomic particles inside the diamond as our qubits. Our design is advantageous because it can work at room temperature, whereas other solid-state designs of quantum computers require temperatures that are even colder than in outer space. Another unique design feature is that by using microwave pulses, we were able to protect the system against decoherence. Our system represents just one possible direction for quantum computers to go. We hope that it will pave the way to bigger and faster systems in the future that may soon rival traditional computers.
That was Daniel Ladar of the University of Southern California. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for an all-new edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions. which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.